science.
It's time to check in on the latest science news. Joining us is Carl Smith. He's a science journalist in Radio National's Science Unit. Carl, welcome to RN Drive.
Hey, Damien.
Firstly, how do you catch a killer using online ancestry sites?
So it's quite an interesting one. I mean, for people who have spat into one of those little vials, paid a small fee, learnt a little about their sort of ancestry and perhaps some of their family members going back in time, could they somehow find themselves the suspect of a criminal investigation? And the recent use of online ancestry sites has led to a pretty high-profile catch. The so-called Golden State Killer in the USA was caught using old DNA samples that were spun up by the criminal investigations team there. And then that DNA sample was uploaded to an open source genetic database. And working with genealogists, they were able to trace back through multiple generations and family trees who the person, the suspect of this crime was.
So that's a fantastic outcome. But now some forensic researchers and scientists are saying the use of these sorts of ancestry sites to catch criminals isn't as reliable as we first thought.
Well, there have been certain cases where some people have been suspects of murders or other investigations, and it's turned out not to be that they were the person who perpetrated that crime. So it's really a matter of, you know, what genetic testing is being done. A lot of these genetic tests don't do a full analysis of your entire genome. They might just look at certain parts of it. So then it becomes a matter of scale. So how much they're looking at in your genetic data and how many people they have in their bank of data as well, and how they're combining that together to try and trace these genealogical histories.
So what are the concerns here about wrongly identifying somebody and that person wrongly being a suspect?
This might be an issue for you on the law report, Damien.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that.
It's one of those interesting ones around consent and implied consent. And when a person is eventually identified as a suspect, whether that changes the use of that genetic material, and now that they've got the name associated with the genetic data, whether that person might have given consent in the first place.
It's a way of following the dots, though, isn't it? Because as I understand it, sometimes, you know, you upload the suspect's DNA and then you get a match for a relative, and then you follow the dots from that relative back to somebody who might have, say, a criminal history or might have been in the area at the time. It's that sort of connecting of dots, isn't it?
Yeah, and I guess for most people in the public, I mean, if you upload your genetic data to one of these sites, you wouldn't necessarily think you're doing so and that it could be used for a criminal investigation.
Mm. Now, Carl, do you have a pet?
At the moment, I do not, but I have had many cats over my years, and I'm a bit of a cat fan, I have to say.
And did you ever take it along to the vet and make it donate blood?
This is something that never crossed my mind until one of our excellent reporters in the science unit, Belinda Smith, looked into whether cats and dogs can donate blood.
And this is happening, right? This is a big thing.
It turns out they can, and that there's actually a real need for cat and dog blood. So there's clinics across many university campuses and others scattered across cities in Australia where dogs and cats can donate blood.
And there's, what, a blood bank for cats and dogs?
Exactly. So similarly to with humans, they might use fresh blood for transfusions of a pet that has perhaps fallen ill or been hit by a car.
Or surgery, maybe.
Or surgery, exactly. But the blood can also be separated out, the plasma and the red blood cells, and then stored away in those different states for a period of time, and then defrosted and used for transfusions in the future.
Now, humans, of course, have to go through a screening process before they give blood to make sure they don't have, you know, certain diseases. Is it the same for cats and dogs, I wonder?
So some of the things that these clinics will look for is, first and foremost, the size of the animal. So you want to make sure that it's big enough and that it's healthy enough. There's also the willingness of the animal, especially with dogs. If they're going to shy away from coming into the clinic, then they might not be the right candidate for blood transfusion or for a blood donation. Although with cats, it's a slightly different process.
Why? Why is it different for cats?
just in terms of the process, it's very different. So for dogs and humans, it's roughly the same. They even take the same amount of blood from a dog as they would from a human in one of these donations. And they use very similar equipment to what they would use with humans. But with cats, they're much smaller and the veins are a little harder to get to. So there's a specialized syringe and tube and they take much less blood.
Hey, lastly, Carl, some researchers in faraway Iceland have discovered a new way to detect earthquakes or oncoming earthquakes. What's the innovation here?
This is actually a very interesting piece of research that kind of could revolutionize how we understand earthquakes and predict earthquakes as well. So they used underground optic cables that were used for telecommunications, and they fired a laser through them and measured the movement of these optic fiber cables based on that laser. So when the cable was stretched ever so slightly, the beam of the laser was changed enough so that they could predict perhaps a wave of seismic activity. Now, one of the big problems with existing seismic activity monitors is that they're spaced very far apart, they're quite expensive, but if you can use the underwater network or underground networks of optic cables that we're developing for telecommunications and putting around the world, if you can use those for seismic detection, then suddenly you've got this immense network and you can record at much finer intervals. So you can accurately measure an earthquake as it's happening, the changes to the fault lines as an earthquake is happening. And you can measure it over time because those cables are locked in place under the water or under the ground.
So you can monitor what's happening, but can you predict what's going to happen in the future?
I think the researchers said that this data they're collecting may help predict both when earthquakes are going to occur, but also how big they're going to be as well. So they can piggyback off these optic fiber cables. But at the moment, they also have to put on special sensors to collect this data across certain cable networks. And at the moment, those are expensive because this technology is brand new. But they're hoping that they'll be able to bring the cost down over time.
Carl Smith, thank you very much for speaking to RN Drive this evening.
Thanks, Damien.
Carl Smith is a science journalist in Radio National's Science Unit. Coming up to the news.